Welcome to Electronically Yours with Martin Ware.
Hi, it's Martin here, Electronically Yours, once again. Today's guest, I've been trying to get on the show for about a year. We've actually worked together, and I'm such an admirer of his work and one of the most iconic records ever made, which was number one in God knows how many countries across the globe, including the UK, a lot of Europe and the US. His name is Robin Scott, his band is called M, and the famous track I'm talking about, of course, is Pop Music. He is a very interesting guy who came from, quite an interesting background, originating from a kind of folk kind of thing. He actually performed on, he shared bills with Bowie and John Martin and Ralph McTell and people like that. He's interested in multimedia projects from like 1970. He's been signed to loads of different labels. He wrote a musical called Heartaches and Teardrops, which was like similar in some ways to Rocky Horror Show. He managed a band called Rugulator. He worked with Julian Temple in The Slits. He's, oh my goodness, Wally Badarou, Gary Barnacle. His daughter Berenice, until recently, was the keyboard player in Heaven 17. And actually, we'll be doing some more shows with us this year as well. He's worked with Ryuichi Sakamoto, Adrian Belew. He's done BEF shows with us in the past as well. A really fascinating guy. Big friends with Malcolm McLaren and particularly Vivian Westwood. Was invited to participate in the opening of their store Sex, but he declined it. What a dude. Here he is, Robin Scott. Yeah, how are you keeping?
Fine. I mean, unfortunately, as I said to you when I in an email, basically the connection here is just terrible. Because I'm in the Black Mountains in Wales. I've got a lovely kind of studio working environment, but unfortunately, well, I say unfortunately because it's literally the guys. I sent you a picture of the Open Reach. They're up on the road there, and they're actually at it. And so certainly by the end of March, we'll have, a serious connection. Well, it's going to be FTTP, which is fiber to the property. And that's, up to 1,000 meg or whatever, you know.
So don't worry about it because I will explain. Well, I am explaining right at this moment to the podcast listeners that we often have to deal with various limitations. The worst one was I did Martin Fry and it was in Barbados and he had like the worst signal imaginable, but this is so much better, so don't worry about it.
All right.
Anyway, let's crack on, shall we? This has taken a long time to get together and I presume that's because not only have you been busy, but you've got some stuff coming out. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. Well, I tell you what, there is something emerging in April, but I have to keep it under wraps BMG have instructed me to do that. I can only say that it has something to do with Record Store Day, that's all. So there's a bit of there's a tight one on that. But apart from that, I mean, basically, what we're looking ahead, they've kind of, well, together between us, we've sort of kind of stumbled across one or two things in the catalogue. Well, they weren't even in the catalogue. They were just kind of sitting around, you know, not doing anything, and they'd never been released. And they ran it past their American colleagues, and they got very excited about it. And so, I mean, this is all down to one guy in particular at BMG who's been very resourceful and incredibly helpful. I mean, I'm surprised. I re-signed with BMG a couple of years back, and they have been very proactive of recent, and I'm really.
Is that BMG the publishers? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, BMG Publishing, but this is the label too. So they're they're all on board, and it's very encouraging. And you know, so it's kind of, you know, how it sort of motivates you to sort of get down to sort of working on new material, or whatever, because there's a promise that hopefully it's all going to see the light of day, because nothing worse than sort of
good Lord, that's the big thing nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah.
And to be honest, I've had some good experiences with BMG recently. They've been very proactive with me, because they've acquired our back catalogue for publishing now as well.
Oh, brilliant. So who are you speaking with there?
I can't remember the... But anyway, they've been very... it's quite unusual for publishers to be quite so positive and proactive. So I'm very happy to give credit where it's due. It's a bit like being a... I think publishing's a bit like being a referee in a football game. You know, they never get the credit when it's good.
That's right.
But they get loads of criticism when it's not. So anyway, hopefully this will mean that they are very happy and they might, you know, give us a new deal or something. Anyway, okay, let's start at the start of your development. I mean, I've been doing obviously some research and I never realised that you were involved with Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood and. Tell us about that.
Well, this kind of goes back to the art school days, really. Basically, I'm just trying to think when I was first at art school. Yeah, this was sort of kind of, late 60s. And that's when I met up with Malcolm. And we just became sparring partners sort of in, you know, the trappings of the student studios. And we spent a lot of time together. And then he introduced me to Vivian, who came into his life at that point, because they were both at Harrow School of Art. And he came from Harrow when he came to Croydon, where I was. And that was how the relationship was kind of, that's how it was kicked off in the first instance. And, how much do you want to know?
What interests me in particular, Robin, is this, I've interviewed obviously quite a few people on the podcast now, and this evocation of period is so, you know, the things that you and I take for granted to a certain extent as, well, that's just what happened, you know, and is a matter of extreme fascination to a lot of people who can't imagine a world which was so kind of creatively burgeoning, you know, in the post kind of hippie era, really. And so I find your story fascinating. I particularly like the fact that you came from a kind of folk music kind of provenance as well. So, and because I always liked the kind of folk influence in the way that music developed from that period on into psychedelia and all that stuff. What do you feel about that?
Well, my interest in folk music, if you like, was really the content, the narrative. And that's where, I mean, I wasn't drawn to country music as such, but in folk music at that time, obviously in the 60s, with the advent of Dylan and Leonard Cohen and all these other luminaries, it was kind of, I was drawn to it because I just felt there was something, it was, you know, in fact, there is a parallel, I think, to be drawn between the narrative of the kind of punk era and the folk music of the 60s, because it was breaking out. It was like, it was that kind of crossover appeal because of the content. And that's what I was drawn to. So initially, that was my first, that was the first debut. And that was, I was doing topical songs on TV at that time.
Mighty Baby, was it?
Well, that's right. Mighty Baby came into the picture because when I was doing these topical songs, I was kind of ringing up, television producers and say, "Look, I got a song for today," or something, and they'd ask me to step in and sort of kind of play it to them. Then they put me on. These were kind of using magazine programs, kind of sort of like doing muse features and stuff, and they'd pop in, you know, people like. Jake Thackeray, that era, that sort of ilk.
I remember Jake Thackeray on the shows on TV. That was funny, wasn't it? Sister Josephine, all that stuff.
So I used to call him up and do that, and I sort of had quite a, you know, it was quite a sort of a kind of knack of getting hold of people. Well, in those days, it was so much easier anyway. I mean, you could swan into BBC Broadcasting House without any ID or anything and just show up. So wow. I had on one occasion, I was doing the John Peel show, and I'd also landed a program called Late Night Lineup with Joan Bakewell.
I remember that.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, I did that. I did it on the same night. So I was kind of taking a cab across London, from Broadcasting House to BBC Television Centre to do the Joan Bakewell show. And I got this call from a guy called Sandy Roberton, who was just kind of, he was really kind of, how should I say? Well, he was intrigued. He said, look, how did you manage to get on the Peel show? Now you're doing Jane Bakewell on the same evening. You know, what kind of agent have you got? Well, I didn't have anybody. Didn't have any management or anything. I just was calling people up. He said, look, I think we should get together. And I said, okay. So then he proposed the idea of putting this album together, which we recorded in one day with the band he brought in was Mighty Baby. And I had a bunch of songs and I was doing a few co-writes with an old friend of mine, or two friends, in fact. So that was cobbled together very quickly. And that was the beginning. But I was sort of, I wasn't easy. I was a bit difficult, you know, as a sort of an artist, if you like. I was a bit of a, when it came to stuff like artwork, because having come from art school, I was a bit of a control freak. And if things weren't to my liking, as I did, I kind of sort of became very disgruntled. And I just felt that, you know, it would, the challenge for all artists was really to be, you know, kind of have that artistic control in all areas, really. So for a while, so I just did that album. And then I kind of, you know, sort of went off in different directions. I was kind of putting together an idea for him. Ideas for a musical and
oh yeah, tell me about this musical, because I was looking on Wikipedia. It says Heartaches and Teardrops, right?
That's it, yeah.
And it said there's parallels to it. Was kind of like well, you can tell me, but it said on Wikipedia it's to do with kind of a musical based around comic strip romance.
Absolutely, yeah. And well, anyway, so I'd put together a bunch of songs, and I approached a company called EG Management, and they looked after some quite big names in their time. I'd already Roxy Music. And I had already had some kind of tentative publishing arrangement with a company called Leeds Music. I don't think it was like, you know, a huge commitment or anything, but I got it in my head that I'd kind of sort of given them rights to myself as a writer. Anyway, the EG Management were very hot to trot, and they said, you know, would you be interested in having Tim Rice come in and do lyrics with you? And I said, yeah, sounds like a great idea. And they said, now we will be interested, we want your publishing, because, like, you know, that's the collateral we need to raise funds for this production. And I said, okay. And I was sort of kind of, this is where I could have, you know, if I'd had management at the time, they'd given the right advice and would have probably recognized that, okay, you've got a couple of publishing companies who are vying for the same, you know, writer or whatever. They could have worked something out. But I sort of shied away from it. I just thought, oh, there's no hope. If they're asking me for publishing, I've got to walk away from this. I can't do it. So that never happened. I've still got all the songs, though.
Right.
I mean, the whole comic strip thing was fascinating me. And then there was the crossover, the Lichtenstein thing, you know, again, sort of all the time I was kind of marrying music in my head with the images and stuff. And I thought had some real possibilities. And the, you know, the Rocky Horror Show was really not exactly in the same genre, but it was, that was the time. And I think, you know, it had that sort of appeal, you know, popular culture crashing with, you know.
Can I just interrupt you there for a sec? Because,
yeah,
I mean, you mentioned this, the inspiration, because you obviously came from art school, and the inspiration was very kind of visual and almost, I suppose, synesthetic to a certain extent. And that fascinates me. You know, I completely understand it, although I never went to art school. But I completely understand how you can derive inspiration from the visual world and use that as kind of nucleation points for starting writing. Because I often think, when I'm writing, I often think there's some kind of movie playing in my head which I'm creating a soundtrack for. It's quite a common trope with me personally, and I thought I was weird. But it sounds like it's quite a common thing. I've heard other people say this.
Yeah, well, I think it's probably down to where, you know, it's the sort of the mindset. How does one connect these creative impulses, if you like, join the dots and sort of think laterally and do something different. And I think that one does think differently when you're thinking in terms of the visual media. If you're thinking about that particular discipline, it's a different story to thinking about music. What's the difference? Feeling. But if you can kind of bring the two together somehow, it starts to get really interesting. And I think, I suppose when I look back, okay, I have to say that, when I was kind of, when germinating this idea of this, very commercial pop song, was thinking, I was flashing on Repetition and the, Warhol. That was all those kind of things were bouncing around my head. And, coming from that sort of mindset, it was like giving me sort of kind of a little, how shall I say, ammunition to come up with something which was a bit off the wall, a bit different, a bit quirky, as people described it.
I think you're kind of like a very strong example of a kind of postmodernist attitude towards composition. It's like there's a knowing wink towards understanding the kind of cultural context of what you're doing, and it's like, here we are. I mean, like, all right, let's address the elephant in the room. Pop music is a work of genius, right? So, and as evidenced by the fact it was a massive success all over the world. But it really is like, in production terms, I found it incredibly inspiring as well for me as a producer later, because it was so elegantly modern and kind of almost brutalist in its arrangement stuff and kind of angular. And that's how I viewed that song, but it's also just a great piece of pop music. What's your view on your magnum opus, I suppose?
Well, obviously now I kind of sort of, I'm sort of happy that it's kind of embedded itself to some degree in people's consciousness, and I've sort of let go of it. I don't care what people do with it. I get BMG, they get so many requests for clearances, to use it in some shape or form. There have been so many remixes of it. There've been so many sampling of it. I'm not precious about it at all. I say yes to everything when they ask for a clearance. When I look back, I mean, the intensity of actually, I was really driven at the time to arrive at something that really surprised me. And I had to go around the block a bit. I mean, the version that you're familiar with was the third version.
Really? What were the first two like?
The first version was like a rhythm and blues version. I had managed this band called Rugulator for some time, and I sort of, a lot of that rubbed off on me, James Brown, all the rest of it. So there was that version, the rhythm and blues, and then it morphed into a kind of funk version. But I knew it still wasn't there yet. It just wasn't right. And then I reflected on a friend that I had, who was, in fact, he was a classical composer, an organist, but he had a little studio in Covent Garden, he was patronized by Pete Townsend, in fact. He funded him to put together, sort of breaking ground synthesizer materials. I mean, I think it was EMS people, material like that. Yeah. And he was just doing little ads for TV ads, putting these kind of jingles together, but he was using sequencing. And he had this ability to arrange, and he had this fabulous ear, because, what he often did, as part of his living, was to write a piece on the train and go and deliver an organ recital. He was from Canada, and a guy called John Lewis, and sadly is not with us. And I knew he had this little studio going in Covent Garden. So I called him up. We spent quite a lot of time working together and doing sort of, the likes of John Peel shows and, worked. And I spent time working in Maida Vale with Radiophonic Workshop. I mean, there's a whole load of stuff there. I won't go into I digress. Anyway, so I called him up. I said, John, look, I've got this track, because I was in Paris at the time trying to, kick this together, because I knew I had some kind of an idea, and I had sort of the basis of the song, and I had, if you like, sort of done these versions. And I said, look, I'm looking for something kind of special, so, you know, the bedrock of a new sound, if you like. And can I come over and, you know, sort of see what happens? So he had an 8-track recorder in his studio, and I just gave him the parts, basically, you know, sort of played what, you know, the progression, which was only a 3-chord trick, and a bass line, and suggested that maybe at the beginning, you know, let's have a glorious fanfare, you know, for God's sake, this is about, you know, like a cultural phenomenon of, you know, looking back or whatever. And so, yeah, we put together an 8-track, and I thought, wow, this is something special, because it was sequenced, you know, that was it, you know, it was right on the nut, right on the money, you know. I mean, I knew that the likes of Giorgio Moroder was using that. And pardon?
How did you sequence it?
Oh, well, basically he had, his setup was, he was just, you know, he wasn't using like software that we're using now. He was using whatever was available at the time. And I guess, do you know, I couldn't really sort of explain clearly what he was using, in terms of kind of, you know, synthesizers and shit, you know, it's just like he would drum it up. Anyway, he put together, he must have had a click and worked with a click of some, you know, basically, you know, remember the early Total Recalls on desks and everything, they had sort of code and all that sort of thing. So he must have been sort of doing something in that territory, as was what's his name? Oh, Voorhaus. David Voorhaus, was it? You know.
I've interviewed David. He's, I mean, he was way ahead of his time with White Noise. Now.
He had some cranky setup called, he called it the Maniac, and it became, I used that idea as a song on a later album. Anyway, so I approached John, walked out with an 8-track, went back to Paris, and I thought, okay, now what am I going to do? Because I've got to get this onto 24 tracks. So I hunted around Paris to find a studio which had a 24 and an 8-track together, and I found one, bounced the 8-track onto 24. Then I went back to Aquarium Studios in Paris, where I had been producing material for Barclay Records, and I had a good relationship with the engineer there. And I said, look, if you've got any downtime, can you give me some downtime? I said, yeah, okay. So I went in then at that stage with the 24 track, and then I built up the piece. Basically, I had this idea, this romantic idea, that I'm pretty sure this was the case too, that Giorgio Moroder was you know, recording each track separately to get maximum separation on each track. So he was doing everything separately. So I thought, okay, it's going to be laborious, this. We're going to have to do it like do the bass drum, a hi-hat, the snare, the whole fucking lot. Did everything separately as they could, as separate as they could. And of course, there was no sampling in those days. So like Bridget had to do the sort of layers of the vocals, the four-part harmony. She had to do every single one throughout the song to get that right. And then I got a sax player in. Then I came across this brilliant musician, Wally Badarou, you know, who had already, he had had a reputation there in Paris for working with, you know, doing sort of soundtracks for blue movies and stuff. And I introduced him to Justin Hildreth, who was also a drummer that I'd been working with. And, so they became a unit, and together with my brother, they were the three-piece. They started doing these blue movie soundtracks. But I dragged Wally, I called him up and said, look, can you come in on this track? And I'm putting together Aquarium Studios. So he came down, listened to it, and came up with these just marvelous sort of kind of feels that he had, you know, his syncopation and everything was just really impressive, which he went on to demonstrate with, you know, those that he worked with in Nassau and, of course, Level 42. And, you know, he just has that tremendous ability, really great musical mind, just and a pleasure to work with. Anyway, so that was where it all came together, and I was kind of, obviously, you know, tremendously grateful to Dominique Blanc-Francard, who was, or still is, he's, you know, he's been a very successful engineer in his time. He wasn't the owner of the studio, But there was a strange dynamic going on between himself and the owner of the studio, and it was all falling apart. I remember at one point I said, Dominic, I've got to get this mixed, you know, I've got to get this mixed. And he said, well, yeah, but we're parting company. The studio's closing. I said, what? You know, can't happen. I said, so I rang up the guy who owned the studio. I said, look, I must get in there and do the studio. I must do this mix, you know. So I got in and did the mix. And I don't know how he got word of it, but Seymour Stein walked in the door at one point, and he was the first one to hear it, and he got very excited. Anyway, I did the, finished the track up, and then I just was going to take a break and take a little holiday, because, I mean, this all had taken a long time, because on downtime, you know, it was kind of getting back in there, getting up to speed and kind of making sense of it. It took a long time to record the track and make sense of it. So I took a break, and Dominic said he would talk to, you know, labels or whatever and see if he could get a deal. And came back from holiday and nothing had happened. So I thought, oh, God, this is not good. So I went in and to meet up with somebody that was running the A&R department in EMI in Paris, Jackie Perriman.
Oh, I know Jackie.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, well, God, well, I walked in her office and fell in love with her straight away.
Jackie's great.
Beautiful lady. Anyway, and I played her a track. I said, look, you know, have a listen to this. And she said, how much do you want?
Thought, really?
This sounds good. So we struck a deal, and I thought, okay, this is a good start. And then the next thing was, because I'd already had a single out prior to that, Modern Man, which came out with MCA. And I said, look, I've got this track, it's it'd be a great follow up to the first single, which got a fair amount of attention, but it didn't get the traction that I'd hoped for. It's the players on Capital Radio and stuff like that. But, it didn't really go anywhere seriously. But then I was coming in with this track, and I was kind of, I felt that the moment was right. And I was working with, Jean-Baptiste Mondino, who went on to do a lot of music videos and stuff, and he was a serious photographer at the time. So we worked on the sleeve. So the whole thing was kind of coming together. And then I sent off a demo to one of the guys that I knew from Barclay Records, Fabrice Coutard, who was he was the guy behind Enigma. And he heard the track and he was really excited. And I said, well, okay, you know, I haven't sort of, you know, given it away entirely. What do you want to do? But they were slow. So I went back to London and spoke to the connection I had at MCA, Roy Featherstone, who again is no longer with us, sadly. But anyway, and he saw it right away. And he said, great, okay. So that was really sort of wrapping it up and getting it into the marketplace. That's how it had happened. And it wasn't easy. But I had the tenacity and the conviction that this is one I've got to get off my chest. And I remember Malcolm, when he heard it, he said, this is either going to be huge or it's going to do absolutely nothing. And I said, you know what? I feel exactly the same way. Who cares? I really enjoyed doing it. I think it sounds pretty good. So,
well, I think the thing is about pop music is, apart from the fanfare at the front, which is amusing, as soon as it grabs your attention, which is the purpose of an intro as far as I'm concerned, so on the radio in particular, but then as soon as it launches into the bang, 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 I mean, that's such a unique... I mean, it's the whole track is one giant hook, you know. Is I presume that's guitar, isn't it?
It is, yes. That was my contribution. three notes.
Very evocative, because it's like it evokes a kind of bygone period, but in a very modernistic way, with the really kind of angular beat and the everything else to do with it, and the very precise backing vocal arrangements and your kind of David Byrne-esque delivery was really cool as well. And I just love, I mean, of course, everybody loves that track. And I occasionally DJ that period, and, you know, it's a floor filler as well, which is great news generally, isn't it? So, and also, you had a curious look on Top of the Pops. Because
the German industrialist, that's what somebody once said. He's the son of a German industrialist, that's what they said.
That's quite good. Actually, it's kind of, you think, oh, at first sight, you think, oh, this guy looks a bit straight, but it doesn't sound straight. The song doesn't sound straight. And then you realize it's actually got more, I always thought you had more in common with that kind of David Byrne-esque playing with the medium, you know, kind of thing. And of course, the band looked great and et cetera, you know. So, tell me about the, for people who don't know the details, how well did the song do internationally?
I think it was number one, probably about 14 or 15 countries.
In the US as well?
Oh, yeah, it was number one in the US, yeah. I mean, it was a long time in Germany, Australia, all over Europe. Yeah, I mean, you know, the exposure that one can get today is something else, isn't it, in terms of, like, you know, the reach. But, I mean, it was kind of, there was a sort of messy moving the masters around. I remember that in Switzerland, excuse me, they were so desperate to get hold of, they couldn't wait for the master, they just took basically a pressing, you know, with a single commercial release from France and just remastered it from this commercial single in the shop, you know. So it did, but it was that, it was the video that was kind of, and Kenny Everett really was initially the responsible for that first airplay, and that was, because they wouldn't play on BBC because they wouldn't have outside production houses contributions at all on Top of the Pops at that time. So it was down to that exposure from Kenny Everett, which then was syndicated and went, you know, around the planet, as it were. And that gave it a real kick up the arse. Cause I think the only other, music video around that time, and it was the same, video production company, Scott and Lady Grant, that produced the Bohemian Rhapsody. So that they did that initially, Bohemian Rhapsody, and then they came around knocking on labels' doors and saying, look, have you got any artists want to get into this new medium? And when Roy Featherstone said to me, look, Robin, are you interested in doing a video? And I said, yeah. So that was a huge asset because there was no band playing live. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's the same with Heaven 17. You know, we didn't perform live. We were a studio band. But we did TV.
Yeah.
I mean, you presumably went all over Europe and everything. Did
drove me nuts. And I hated lip sync. I hated it with a vengeance. You know, I really wanted just to sing. I really wanted to kind of just do it live. That was really sort of frustrating. But, you know, fucking lip sync.
So it must have gone to your head, did it?
How do you mean?
No, when you have, I mean, I've never had that kind of success, but I know a few people who had. And it has kind of massively altered their perception of their status.
Well, I'll let you into a secret. Basically, in that period, when I was sort of kind of, there was something niggling inside in terms of, that was driving me. I had recently lost my father and I was so fucking angry. I was just so angry, you know. And, because I love my father so much, and it was under all the wrong circumstances. You know, I felt it shouldn't have happened. Anyway, it did. And I was just so driven to kind of I became a, you know, real control freak. You know, I just was really, you know, when people approached me in terms of potential management, whatever, I couldn't deal with it. I just felt so paranoid that basically they were going to take advantage of me as in the way that I felt my father had been taken advantage of. Do you understand what I'm saying? And I just was really kind of like, my defense was being pretty bloody arrogant as well. And so I think, you know, maybe people interpreted that. I don't know how they interpreted it, but it didn't sort of didn't do me any favors. And there were occasions when I got approaches, you know, in different areas, and I couldn't deal with it because there was just too many. I felt I had too many plates in the air spinning at once. And so, I suppose when I look back, I think I didn't really enjoy that moment. The moment that I enjoyed was when I kind of clicked on the idea and I started, you know, I was working, barring away in Paris and doing that. When it came to the point where, okay, I remember moments like this. I was at Clapham Junction on one occasion. I was on one platform and there was this kid on the other platform and he got really excited and started singing out to me. I thought that was a moment. I enjoyed that tremendously. But in terms of getting, I don't know, I remember going to sort of pick up, you know, the awards and stuff. I remember once going down with Buggles' man, Trevor Horn. We both went down to South of France to pick up some awards there. And I quite like that. But I don't know, I just felt, you know, and I've always felt that I like to really be chipping away at the stone. I like to be at the coal face. I'm not really into all the, you know, all that kind of celebrity stuff. I mean, I feel quite, I'm not, you know, I can deal with it, but it's not, I'm not driven by fame.
Yeah.
You know,
fame, again, I've never been as famous as you were, but I regard fame as a pain in the ass, frankly, because it's something that's useful, but it's also completely out of your control. And if you're not careful, it can overtake the real meaning of what you're trying to achieve, which is a kind of artistic endeavor.
It does help. For example, you know, you can get on the guest list easy, or, you know, if you're calling up somebody for favors, it might help. And then it also helps because you have, you know, people approaching you and they feel comfortable to do that because, I don't know, you're in the sort of, an A-list as they call them, don't they? You're in the same tribe or whatever it was. But interestingly enough, and people always make this connection between me and David Bowie, right? And this is because, I mean, we met in going back to 69 again when I had that first album out and I was sort of peddling my songs around the folk clubs and we were playing in a little folk club in Soho called Les Cousins. And I remember I remember that night well because David was on the bill, I was on the bill, and Ralph McTell was on the bill. And it was an interesting evening. And, you know, at that time, we were just sort of people, you know, kind of musicians trying to get a bit of traction in on the circuit and just experimenting. And I remember, you know, he approached me after and said, look, I'm starting up this arts lab in Beckenham. Do you want to come down? And I said, yeah, sure. So that sort of triggered off, and I did that. And then over the years, we kind of kept crossing each other's paths. But I could see, talking about fame, by the time, you know, I was in Switzerland, Montreux at Mountain Studios, which belonged to Queen, because I went there because I met up with Roger Taylor in, where was it? I don't know, Munich or something, doing on the TV thing and circuit. And I was asking him at breakfast, I said, you know, do you know any studios where I could record? I want to find somewhere, you know, I don't want to go back to the UK and record, you know, for tax reasons, all that stuff. It was suggested to me if I continue to record outside the UK, it would be more manageable. So I asked him, he said, yeah, come to Mountain Studios. And I came to Mountain Studios and started recording there. And then, you know, who rings up? It's David, who's living out in Montreux because, you know, he'd had sort of uncomfortable, I don't know, threats, you know, towards his son. Things were getting out of hand for him, fame-wise. And this is like, what was this? I'm just trying to think. Yeah, it'd be sort of 79.
Right.
And I'm at that point, I remember getting into quite an in-depth conversation with him. And he was, you know, we fool around the studio and stuff, and the band were all very excited because, like, you know, David Bowie turned up. And then we went off and we went to another part of the building where they have the festival, the Montreux Jazz Festival. We found a place, quiet place, and we sat down and we sort of chatted for a while. And then I suddenly realized how forlorn he was. He was like really in a very, he was having a really tough time. And I remember him just breaking down in tears at one point. And I just thought, Christ, what is going on? You know, this is like somebody who, you know, over the years, you know, kind of, you know, the body of work and, the, you know, somebody I look up to, and he's just like cracking at the seams. What's happening, you know? I knew that he had Coco, who was like his sort of confidant, and but she, I don't think she was a serious manager. But I think he had a similar kind of, I felt a parallel, like, you know, he didn't really trust him. He was with main man and they fucked him over. And then it was, I don't know, was it Tony DeFreeze? I don't know. These people. Mm-hmm. But he was kind of, that was the point when he was really sort of troubled. And I sort of realized, yeah, so fame doesn't really count for that much, does it?
No, well, I mean, it can be a very lonely place, I can imagine as well. I mean, I often talk about, because I produced Terence Trent D'Arby's first record. He's now known as Sunanda Maitrey.
Oh, yeah. I loved it. What, did you produce that very first album? The one with The Shape of My Heart?
Wishing Well.
The Shape of My Heart.
And Sign Your Name.
Oh, God, I love that album. I could never understand what the hell has happened to Terence Trent D'Arby. I thought, Christ.
Basically, it was afraid he fell off. He didn't indulge in either drinking or drugs and on the first album, but he moved to L.A., and we all know what happens in L.A. And
well, he went off on some religious trip, didn't he? Terence Trent D'Arby.
Yeah. Yeah, he went basically to a place where he got surrounded by acolytes who were spending his money for him, and you know.
Didn't he do a Cat? He did a Cat Stevens, didn't he? Go off on some tangent, some religious thing. I don't know.
No, it's not really. It wasn't religious, but he had a really tough time with the press when they didn't like his second and third albums.
God, so you produced that first album. Bloody hell. Yeah. That's amazing.
Thank you. You're so proud of that. Yeah, I'm exceptionally proud. I've just done a Dolby Atmos mix of it, which sounds incredible, by the way. If you happen to have Apple Music, you should have a listen to it on headphones. It sounds incredible. Anyway, that's not about me. So after that, you released another, I mean, you released Moonlight and Muzak, which is great. And then, obviously your stock is incredibly high at this point, and you are in a position of power, essentially, because everybody on earth, record companies, publishers, everybody must have been, all over you. So what happened after that?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I had, because I was sort of wearing these different hats, like I was managing this band Rugulator for some time, touring around them, driving all around the country, and doing my best to kind of get them. Do you ever hear of Rugulator?
Yeah. I wasn't familiar with their work, but I knew about them.
Danny Adler was the guitarist and the writer, and very clever guy. Unusual, enigmatic, and eccentric, from Cincinnati, Ohio. And anyway, so I got drawn into that because his bass player at the time was drunk. As you say, I'm not sure how much detail to give you here. Because I'm happy to give you as much as you want, but I mean, like, it's quite kind of interesting. All these people are writing books and stuff. I mean, I could write so much, but I just don't. Anyway, so bass man Paul Riley calls me up and said, look, because he's in the band with Rugulator, with Danny Adler. He said, look, we're really struggling. He was offered this deal with, who was it? I can't remember the label or anyway. And he's sort of blown it because we had sent us page spread in NME and we were all over the place. And he's just kind of blown it, this deal with the label. And I don't know what to do. And he said, look, do you fancy managing? I said, what? I said, okay, I'll give it a go. So that, 2 years of that. And
why would you want to manage a band? It's weird.
Well, because I don't know. I just really, I loved his kind of, the whole ethos of Rugulator was really, he had a really kind of interesting sort of insight into James Brown and his kind of way he was sort of running the show. And I think he was trying to emulate that. But also I felt sort of not sorry for him, but I felt very sympathetic towards what he was trying to achieve. And I felt though he deserved it. And there was another member of that band, a guy called Nick Pletus, who I think played with
Nick. My God, he's one of my oldest mates.
Yeah, well, he's my, yeah, old man of mine too. Lovely guy. I tried to get in touch with him, oh, I don't know, about a year or two ago, but I mean, it just fizzled out. It didn't happen. Anyway, he was in the band. And so, yeah. And Bobby Owen, who's the most brilliant drummer, he's not around now anymore either. So Paul Riley, Nick Pletus, Bobby Owen, I can't remember who else was there besides Danny. It was, who was playing? Oh, yeah, I think that was possibly the lineup. Anyway, so I was drawn because I just thought these are great players and I just want to support what they're doing. And I hadn't really, I wasn't sort of eyeing up the producer's ball, but I think they were interested in me producing because I had put a label together and I started producing a few acts. And then, you know, Adam Ant walked in the door and I sort of pointed him in the direction of this little label I had. And so I was in the swim of it all and I thought, why not? Why not just do that? Why not get involved in, you know, after all, I am a control freak. So
yeah, it seems like you wanted to do everything. It's a bit like that version of, you know, it's like the kind of the contemporary version would be like Kanye West or somebody like that, or Jay-Z.
Right. Okay. So anyway, we were working together for a while. What was the United Artists? That was the deal that failed on Rugalator. So it never happened. But then we got involved. Oh, yeah. Then I took them to Richard Branson at Virgin. And they were his cousin. What was his cousin's name? Richard Branson's cousin. He was working on.
God. Can't remember. Jumbo? No.
Well, he was somebody there, yeah. But there was somebody else there. I'll come to him in a minute. Anyway, they were really up for Rugalator, and I made a bit of a boob. We pretty much had a deal on the table, and they said they wanted to come and see the band. And I should at that point said, no, let's just do the deal first. And they came to a bad night. They came to the Nashville to see him play. And they were that kind of band. And, you know, Danny was that kind of an artist that, you know, he was, yeah, a little bit off the wall. Sometimes, you know, it was just like, this is shit. And then sometimes, this is amazing, you know. Anyway, they came to a bad night and they went completely cold on it. And I managed to persuade them to do one single, which Nick wrote, a song called Love and the Single Girl. And I designed the cover for him and I just thought this could go. But it didn't. And I think Danny was a bit upset because, like, it wasn't going to be his song, you know, first. And then Danny turned around and said, look, I'll pay for the album. Robin, will you produce it? And I said, yeah, okay. So I produced their first album, Play It By Ear. That was it. You know, a little pun on Bert Wheaton. And that's how that happened. And I got sort of kind of, yeah, the feel for the whole production thing. But that was, at this point, I wasn't, you know, delivering anything myself. And it wasn't until I went to Paris, going back again to the days that I was kind of working with Malcolm. And he had, I was quite involved in the sort of epicenter of, like, you know, what was going on with the Pistols and stuff. He turned up with the Pistols in my flat in Richmond and said, you know, what am I going to do? And there was, but anyway, he came up with this idea of packing me off to Paris with a band called The Slits, because The Slits had approached him and they thought...
I love The Slits.
Yeah, and he thought they were going to be the answer to everything. He was going to be the answer to everything, but he didn't want to know it because the Pistols had just imploded and he was really pissed off at the Pistols because they'd never even bought him a drink. It was all going to worms. And I said, look, well, what about this band, The Slits? And he said, oh, you just take him to Paris, go and see what's his name in the Gibus, you know, the nightclub there, and take Julian Temple and go and record them. And I said, okay. So off we went, and Julian did the filming, and I recorded them with the Rack Mobile, and then I started to get into conversation with Viv Albertine, and you know, I rather liked Viv, I have to say. And we were sitting in the bar and having a chat and everything, and I was telling her about what I got up to and all the different hats I was wearing. She said, why don't you do something yourself, you know? And it was, you know, on that note that I actually thought, Yeah, why not? Why not? Yeah, I'm sort of kind of trying to get these other artists going, but why not have a go myself? So she, I owe that moment to her when she, you know, because that stuck in my mind. I thought, yeah, I'm going to have a go. So that's when I started, you know, putting together that first single, Modern Man. And so there are all these funny, it's interesting, Martin, all these sort of little links that come flashing back to you when you have these conversations, you know.
It's amazing. I mean, I must admit that when I did the... my autobiography, available at all good bookshops.
Oh, you've done one, have you?
Yeah, yeah. Called Electronically Yours, the same as the podcast. And when I did that, I found it an incredibly interesting procedure. I did it during lockdown because I was bored. And do you know, so much of the stuff, I realized I had to rely on my friends to remind me what the hell happened, when, and if, not just when. It really makes you think about your life in a different way, not in a nostalgic way, but in a kind of reappraisal way. And I think you should definitely do an autobiography if you've not done one.
I like the idea of joining all these sort of glamorous dots of all the people that I've kind of had, you know, made connection with, because I mean, there have been moments, they're seminal moments, and they have sort of shaped me as I am today, you know, and they've kind of, I think I'm a better person than I was then. And there are quite a few situations and opportunities which I probably could have, you know, made sense of had I had the head on that I have on now. But I mean, that's the benefit of hindsight, isn't it? You know.
Well, if you're interested in, I can introduce you to my literary agent, darling. And
oh, really?
Yeah, I'm sure they'd be very interested if you were serious. Anyway.
Well, that's something I think maybe later this year, because I don't know. I have quite a good feeling about this year. And yeah. I think that's why I sort of thought it was time actually to chat to you, Martin, because I didn't feel that I really had the right kind of energy to think about it. But like, you know, it's all flashing by a bit quick, isn't it?
Just got to get on with it, mate. And you know, the time for navel gazing is gone. There won't be a navel to gaze at soon. So you just got to get on with it. But so I just want to quickly touch on your love of African music and the African project kind of thing that you went down. Tell us about that.
Well, I was, I think at the time, I think again, this is sort of around the time, I was still spending time with Malcolm, and he was sort of flashing on the possibilities of, you know, maybe kind of collaborating with, you know, third world musicians or whatever. And I went into a nightclub in Piccadilly, and there were these three girls that were, they were Zulus basically. And, they were just doing this incredible act. They call it the gumboot dance or something. But I was struck by their vocals. I thought, my God, they're just really fantastic. They're three part harmony. And, I approached him. I said, look, would you be interested in maybe collaborating on some material and recording something? And these, the three of them, they're called Shakisha. And I invited them down to Sussex, and we started kind of, you know, looking at the possibility of actually, you know, vocalizing together. And I said, look, I've got this new contraption called a Fairlight, and I'll put some, you know, pieces together, and then we'll see if we can, you know, get together again and lay down some vocals. So we did that. And then I took that material out to Nairobi because I wanted some live players. And that was a fantastic experience. My God, you know, they're just so eager to work and just so full of energy. And they, you know, they would borrow, you know, steel instruments just to be there in the studio. And I remember when we were working in the studio, I took a guy, an Australian friend, Norman Michel, he worked for Island Records, or was it Virgin? I don't know. But I took him with me. He's an engineer, superb engineer. And we went to this studio, which was CBS Studios in Nairobi, and we pretty much had to rewire it because it was really ancient. And then we sort of put the word out that we wanted players to come in, you know. And boy, did they come in. And they stayed in the studio. And we would just be sort of kind of sampling these different guys playing on the track. It was all a little bit sort of disorganized, but it was just such a thrilling experience. And the high life spirit that came from, you know, these players that decided to work. Tabu Frontal, he was just a great player. And then there was, I don't know whether you remember the track on there. It's called Africa, which was, that was written by one of these guys. And I just thought, that's amazing. And I got the girls singing that. And oh, it was a fabulous period. I think when I look back as a recording experience, just like being in the milieu of like these, you know, creative vibes, that was the best for me, that album. I really enjoyed that more than anything.
And what was the album called?
Jive Shakisha. But sadly, there was a little bit of a sad ending. Okay, so I'll go into that one. The album was done, and I approached Eddie Grant's manager. I just can't for my life remember his name now. But anyway, he suddenly saw that there was huge potential because, like, the Anglo-African thing was sort of, like, you know, on the cusp of happening at the time. Lombardo, do you remember that track that had happened? Do you remember there? That was a big track. And he saw the potential in this. And I was just going to go off on a little skiing trip, which I did. And I left him with it because I'd already opened the door to a subsidiary label of Virgin called 10 Records.
I put a record out on 10.
Oh, did you? Okay. Well, they were really keen. I mean, to the keen that basically they wanted to sign this album because it was all done. So I went away and left this guy, to negotiate it. And he was, you know, one of these types, you know, fist thumping on the table and demanding $100,000, you know, for the first album. By the time I came back, he'd really pissed the label off. So really kind of blown it in my absence. So I swept him out of the way and went back to them. I said, look, can we at least put one, you know, put a single out or something? So the single, Crazy Zulu, came out and we started promoting that. And I went out and did a few kind of, TV sync things with Shakisha. And I could see the potential of performing with them live. I just really was looking forward to that. I was so excited about that idea. Meanwhile, there was this issue that arose because I wanted to put together a video and I was prepared to fly everybody out there back to Kenya to do that. And there was just one problem, and that was that one of two of the girls had South African passports, and they weren't able to go. Everything was booked up, and I had a guy that was like, he was a BBC producer, and he had a crew that was already down there, and he had everything set up, and I'd had, you know, I was in the process of booking all the tickets and then discovered that the two girls that were South African, because of the racial thing that was going on in South Africa, they wouldn't have them they couldn't get visas to go into, which I thought was absurd. You know, this is ridiculous. They wouldn't have them. They couldn't get visas for them to go to Kenya. So I thought, oh, Christ, this is all booked up. You know, what the hell am I going to do? So one of the girls was married to a guy who worked for British Rail or something, and she had an English passport, so she could go. This was Doreen Webster. Again, it's no longer with us, sadly. Anyway, so she came with me, and we went out back to Kenya, and we put together a video, which was, you know, it's. I don't think it's up on YouTube yet, but I'm said to BMG, we can stick it up there because they've made an artist channel for me now. And we went out there and did that, Dory and I and all the musicians that played on the track and everything. And it was, you know, it was great. But then I came back to a storm because the other two girls had sort of kind of had it in for me because, like, I had kind of favored Doreen and taken her, and they got left behind, and they weren't happy with the argument that they couldn't get visas, and it all started to get very messy. Anyway, I know I did the foolish thing. I recommended somebody for managing them. I put them in touch with somebody, and he saw an opportunity to really kind of take, you know, make a meal out of it. And they were going to sue me for...
Yeah.
So, you know, and I was told that Robin, you need to settle this out of court because they're going to make mincemeat of you. It's this white producer exploiting, you know, black singers. So I thought, okay, shit, you know. So we settled out of court and the album never got released at that time. It didn't get released till 14 years later because of that. And, you know, it really destroyed all my confidence, to be honest, being in the bloody music industry. I just thought, this is ridiculous. You know, this is the happiest album for me. And yet, you know, I couldn't see the light of day. And the opportunity to work with these people, it was, you know, it was...
That's so sad.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, you hear about that again and again and again, this business.
Yeah, exactly. Right, well, we're running out of time here, but... My God, it's flown, hasn't it?
Are you familiar with the song Bride of Fortune?
No.
Don't worry. Okay, so this was a set of lyrics which Vivian came up with when she did her spring collection in 1986. And she was, you know, infatuated with bringing history to life again with her... it was called the mini crinny. You know that when they have those kind of things under the dresses that blow out the sort of hips. Okay, so this collection featured the this particular iconic dress, and it was a collection which I, you know, filmed, and then she said, "Look, I've got a set of lyrics." And, you know, do you want to collaborate and do something with this? So we went down to a studio in Sussex and we found a really excellent keyboard player. I cannot remember his name or find him again because I tell you what, he was something special. Anyway, so he came in too and it was a little sort of country studio tucked away. And Vivian and I produced this track together. It's called The Bride of Fortune and it's her lyrics. And I just basically coasted over the top of it. The idea for her was the theme music that she had for the actual catwalk show was kind of sleazy nightclub, you know, stripper kind of thing. So she wanted it to feature the song David Rose's, you know, the stripper sort of in the chorus, which we did. That's it. And I found there was a girl that I knew that was, which in fact, she's an estate agent, but she just had this really brilliant voice. So she's on it. And then, I stepped in and with, Vivian's lyrics and just kind of, you know, freestyled over the rest of the track. Anyway, I've just completed, you know, putting the video material together that I have with the track, and I can send you a link anyway to what I initially put up very quickly after I heard what had happened with Vivian. So that's up on YouTube, but that's just basically, it's what they call a pack shot. You know what I mean? Pack shot.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, just crediting her with the lyric, and you know, it just says Vivian was 1941 to 2022. So you can hear the track, but what I'm going to do now, I'm going to give BMG also the video that I've done, because that can go up on the channel, the artist channel. But I just really felt, you know, I mean it's a seminal moment, because I mean she actually never collaborated, as far as I know, with any other musical people. She did also put together several sets of lyrics which she gave to Berenice, whom Berenice came up with some ideas, and one track is I like it very much. The others were, you know, very basic, sort of she was quickly demoing her sort of musical thoughts using her lyrics. But it was just such a, you know, a lovely moment. And I remember I was looking, you know, as you do, just go back sort of thinking about somebody like that. And there was some, she always was sending a Christmas card every year. And she, one year she sent, she asked, she said, look, when you come to London, bring Berenice and we must work on the music again, you know. And I was thinking, shit, you know, like, this just, I never made that happen. I never chased her hard enough in the sort of all the noise that was going on around her. Because, I mean, you know, when, you know, just things just kind of just became so enormous and so unmanageable for her. I mean, I know Andreas, who has been, you know, obviously a really supportive figure in her life, you know, in this sort of last 10, 15 years. But, you know, it was very hard to actually kind of slow things down and have that conversation, say, let's do something together again. Because I think that for me, the track, The Bride of Fortune, and I just, when I hear it back and I think of the vocal that I blasted out on that, I just think, God, I must have been in such a good headspace. And I would love to, I would love to have worked together again with her more. And I just think, you know, for me, so it's big sad loss.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Anyway, well, I must let the podcast listeners know that the Berenice, the aforementioned Berenice, is of course Robbie's, yes, Robbie's daughter, and also used to be keyboard player till recently. Actually, is going to be performing with us again this year on a couple of gigs. Used to be our keyboard player for M17, so and BEF, and Robin also performed very kindly with us with BEF, which is also happening again this year. And yeah, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Shall I start the recording?
No.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I thought you were just...
No, no, we're getting to the end of our chat now. But I always have to ask people these stupid questions at the end, which are a bit of an insight into people's character, basically. So what's your favourite film?
Okay, well, I did like... Philadelphia with Tom Hanks, you know, Springsteen's music.
Oh, yeah, that was good. Yeah. Okay, favourite TV show or series or past, present, box set, anything?
Well, I tell you what, I've been really impressed with Marie Antoinette on BBC iPlayer. Have you seen that?
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? I really like it. Great production values, yeah.
Yeah, or Breaking Bad.
Yeah, everybody loves that, don't they? Favourite book?
Favourite book? Well, let me think. I'm reading Tim D at the moment, who kind of he's into the migration of birds, and he's just a fabulous writer, you know, as a naturalist. He's like kind of just, he's just so expressive, so descriptive, and just Tim D.
Tim D, and what's the name of the book?
Well, there is, hold on a second, I'd have to go and get it, so to remind me of the title. Do you want me to hold it? Do you want me to go and look?
No, no, it's all right. I'm sure we can find it online. Is it a current book? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, another brilliant book which you've got to read. Okay, this really stands out, and that's David Attenborough's A Life on Our Planet. Have you read that?
Right. No, I haven't, no.
Oh, you must, and you must see the film on Netflix as well. This man is extraordinary. He's incredible, and I was so impressed by that book. I've never done this before. I wrote to him and told him it was brilliant, and he wrote back, and he was so pleased to hear from me. I was so flattered. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Who's your favourite producer, record producer?
God, blimey. Oh, dear. Well, you are now.
Oh, yeah.
I tell you, I was so pleased to hear that.
Yeah.
No, I'm not kidding. That was just, you know, you should be so proud of that.
I am. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work, I have to say. In all respects.
Yeah, now, you know, people often say to me, "Oh, I wish I'd written that song." Well, I said I would have wished I'd produced that record.
Oh, thanks, man. That's very kind. Favourite songwriter?
Well, I like a lot of Springsteen's early work. I like a lot of Dylan's work. I like a lot of Leonard Cohen's work. Well, you see, they're all kind of folky-type heroes, aren't you? In the early days of Springsteen, I remember seeing Springsteen at the Hammersmith Odeon. That was a seminal concert, and that was filmed. Just Unbelievable. That was just incredible. That would have been, would that have been 75?
I loved his first album. I thought it was fantastic. Anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Okay. If your life had taken a different turn, what do you think an alternative career might have been for you?
Well, you know, I've been painting all the way through. So, I mean, basically, I've always had the choice of two. But, I mean, I kind of struggle trying to keep the balance, to be honest. But what would I have done? What would I have been? Oh, God.
Could you have made a career out of painting, do you think?
Well, I kind of sort of... I sort of feel I'm quite serious about it. I've got a piece that's going into the it's a submission for the summer show at the RA this year, and I've got a very strong feeling about it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you'll get plenty of buyers. You know, I know several artists who are friends of mine who do very well out of that show. Actually, unfulfilled ambition.
God, really? I don't really feel that at the moment. I feel as though kind of I'm managing to... I feel so privileged. I mean, you know, I mean, old age is a privilege, let's face it.
Let's face it, yeah.
And I just feel I'm going to, you know, stay healthy. I mean, I'm pretty active. I like cycling. I want to keep fit and I want to keep going because I just feel I've got so much to do still. So, what was the question again?
Well, I think unfulfilled ambition, but I mean, it's a noble ambition to stay fit and healthy and clear of mind.
Yeah, I don't feel unfulfilled, really. I mean, just feel that.
I meant something like, for instance, mine is I've never had a chance to, or I've never been offered the chance to do a film score, which I'd really like to have a go at.
Oh, right. We should talk to Glenn.
Things like that. well, and he's doing very well at the moment, yeah. But, I mean, I just think a big feature film would be great anyway. It's never going to happen, but there you go. An epiphanal moment in your life, a moment of light bulb realisation or conversion on the road to Damascus or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I mentioned that, actually, to you earlier. I think that moment, I was sort of just sipping a drink with Viv Albertine, and she kind of, you know, she just inspired me.
Cool. Okay. And the final...
What's she doing now? Do you know?
I don't, to be honest. No, I don't. I haven't kept track of that. Final question.
Yeah.
What's your favourite synthesizer?
I have a Mini Moog.
Oh.
And I just had it refurbished. And I'm so glad I hung on to it. I bought it for 500 quid about, I don't know, 20 years ago. And it sat in the box for a long time, but I'm looking at it now. It's really looking quite shiny, and it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's sometimes a little bit unmanageable, but I mean, it's a great piece. But I also got a hold of the Korg. What is it? The one?
The MS-20.
Yeah, and a Nord Stage 3.
Right. I mean, every time I get a chance to play with a Mini Moog, it's all bass lines for me. It just sounds great. I mean, you can't go wrong, can you? It just sounds fat.
No, you're absolutely right.
Robin, it's been an absolute joy. You know, thank you for eventually agreeing to do this, and your stories and your candor are really something that I think people find fascinating and totally engaging. And is there anything you want to plug before we finish?
Not really. I think, you know, I'd only go as far as to say that you know, there is there's stuff in the pipeline which I wouldn't sort of want to share unless I felt very good about, and it's sort of, you know, I feel as if the wind's blowing. Yeah, it's in my sails a bit right now, and I'm
great. We need more of your shit in the world.
Well, yeah, and I'm equally flattered that you've taken the trouble to kind of approach it in the right way, because I mean, so many interviews are just like a little bit naff.
Well, you know, the theory of the podcast is it's like a peer-to-peer conversation, you know, and that we can talk about things in an open and honest way that maybe an interviewer didn't feel comfortable doing or just simply doesn't know about. But we know there are certain common experiences that people who've been through 40 years in the music industry that we have, you know, and you've had as many ups and downs as more ups than downs than I have had. So thank you for this. It's been completely amazing and enlightening, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, a small plug. Mojo, they've just done an article at Guide, because another nice interview actually. So it's got off to a good start this year. I can't remember his second name, but like it's in there. They have, what is it, Buried Treasure. He's done a piece on this.
You're not buried yet.
That's right. No, he was referring to the first. I think he just looked. He wanted to know the background to the first album. And so he dwelt on that. I haven't actually read it. To be honest, I don't really like reading, you know, stuff about me. I'd rather sort of leave it alone. I'll let Helen do that. But anyway, so that was a very nice interview, though. I just did it in the car on the M4, just chatting to him, and it was very pleasant. Somebody else that was, you know, equally well-researched. That's often the problem. You get the feeling that they've just read Wikipedia, nothing else, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, we have a special kind of history together anyway. So thank you again, and I will be putting this out in the next couple of weeks, and I'm sure people will love it. So thanks, Robin. Robin, he's the man. I've got a lot of admiration for people who maintain a kind of thoroughness and rigour and authenticity to what they do, and they don't really compromise. And he strikes me as one of those kind of people. And that's probably why we get on so well. He's a very nice chap as well. And he's Berenice's dad. How is everyone? If you want to email me with comments on the programmes, thanks, or criticisms, praises, grumbles, ideas for sections, ideas for guests, ideas on how to reach them. Email me on electronicallymartin@gmail.com and consider contributing in a tiny way to my Patreon page, which is patreon.com/electronicallyhours, which will help keep this independent and fun and advert free. God, don't you hate those podcasts where it's interrupted by adverts all the time? It just bugs me. I can't deal with it. That's it for this week. Another exciting guest next week. Bye. Next question. Was the CMI Fairlight a help, a hindrance, or something you just had to try out? Well, me and Glenn used to go and write 3 or 4 times a week in the early 80s, round at Ian Marsh's house in Twickenham. And we turned up one day, just a normal day, and without telling us, he'd bought a Fairlight. Not rented one to try. Bought a £30,000 Fairlight. And of course, we were going, this is amazing, you know, blah, blah, blah. But after a few months, it transpired that it wasn't all it was cracked up to be. And I ended up getting an emulator too, which was £3,000, which was actually much better. So there you go. It kind of turned into a doorstop. What is my most prized possession? My health, without a shadow of a doubt. I'm not very good at being ill. And as you get older, various things start going skew-if and everything. So, yeah, no material possession means that much to me. I don't drive. I've no wanted possessions in that sense. all my vinyls in storage. I've given away all my CDs and DVDs. Books I'm still very fond of, but if somebody clicked a finger and said they're going to disappear, it wouldn't break my heart. But, you know, I like a nice telly, big telly. What else? In the studio, I mean, I suppose my Roland System 100 is the most important thing. And my Korg 700S, I'm very fond of both those machines. That's it from Phil, thank you.